Thank you. Let's see, is everything working? This is working. This is working. Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be back. So Steve already stole the punchline of my first slide, which is the year is 2008. This is, I think, the most, assuming that this will happen in 2008, this is the most exciting thing of 2008 for me. So I think excitement driven by curiosity is how I summarize sort of the atmosphere for whoever is involved with this. One of the testaments to the excitement that in the field is that many theorists have converged here at the Kavli Institute for a long workshop, and it's fun to see so many familiar faces. This colloquium is more geared towards those of you who are not here for the workshop, but are wondering, why are we so excited? What are we so curious about? If you are here for the workshop, then you're excited and you know, but I will remind you. And also, what are the challenges that are facing us? Because this is a big project. So, in the last century or so, we have been slowly learning about the laws of physics at increasingly small distances, starting at the atomic scale of an angstrom. We discover that the atom is made out of a nucleus and electrons that are orbiting around it. Then we use some sort of magnifying glass to resolve a much shorter distance. And we discover that the nuclei are actually composite. And we write down, it's made of protons and neutrons, and we could in principle write down a different, completely different Lagrangian for the degrees of freedom at this distance scale. And this is a very complicated Lagrangian. And then we resolve even shorter distances, and we see that the nucleon is composite. And again, new degrees of freedom, new Lagrangian. And we would like to keep going this way. Let's do that. So the next distance scale is, and this is roughly the edge of our knowledge, is roughly 10 to the minus 17 meters. And the theory that describes physics, the Lagrangian that describes physics at this distance scale and slightly larger, is the standard model of particle physics. The degrees of freedom are quarks, leptons, and there are gauge forces, strong and electroweak, that describe the interactions between them. So the LEP experiment and Tevatron that is currently running are the magnifying glasses that have brought us to where our knowledge is. So this is roughly where our knowledge sort of fades away. So we don't know all of the standard model yet, because there's one piece that is missing, which is the Higgs. And I'll go a little bit into what the Higgs is and why it's interesting. The Higgs is responsible for the origin of the mass of all of the elementary particles in the standard model that we know are massive. We know a little bit about it indirectly, so it's scooting a little bit over the line, but it is yet undiscovered. And what's next? So the LHC is going to take us into the unknown, and what do we expect to find? So to zeroth order, we don't know. So this is my best guess for LHC physics. But we have a lot of clues for what we may find. For example, dark matter, cosmological dark matter, may be produced at the LHC, and we may learn something about it. New symmetries, such as supersymmetry, may be discovered. Extra spatial dimensions may be discovered. We may learn something about the grand unification of forces. So these are all deep issues, and we have an opportunity to learn about some of these. I'm sure that some of the people in the audience have models that incorporate most of these in an exciting model for LHC. So the outline of this talk, the question I would like to answer, to convey, is what may we discover at the LHC, and how are we going to discover it? So I will start with the part that was to the left and very near the gray line in the previous slide, which is the standard model. I'll explain a little bit about the weak scale and the Higgs, and how we find the Higgs at the LHC. And then I'll go beyond the standard model and explain some about the clues for beyond the standard model physics. I'll focus on the hierarchy problem, how it is related to symmetry and new symmetries and forces, and then come back to the LHC. So this is the plan. So the standard model, so one place to start talking about the standard model is with this fellow. This is Enrico Fermi. In the 30s, he wrote down a theory for beta decay. Here's a neutron decaying to a proton, an electron, and an antineutrino. And this coupling is a dimensionful coupling. It has an inherent distance scale in it, or an energy scale. And so this is the Fermi constant. The scale associated with this is roughly this 10 to the minus 17 meters, or 240-something GeV. So we've measured this very well and a long time ago. So for all this time, we know that something is interesting. Something interesting is going on in the scale, and still to this day, we don't quite know what. So what is the origin of the scale? Why this number is something we would like to know. We have advanced since the 30s. So we can, again, use a magnifying glass to resolve this interaction. So neutrons and protons are actually composite particles bound by the strong force by QCD. And this beta decay is nothing but a down turning into an up. And that force is mediated by, so this is a much shorter distance scale than this one, by the weak force. And the force, the carriers of the weak force are the W and the Z bosons. And the scale V for from Fermi's interaction is related to the mass of this W boson. So because the W is massive, its wave function decays exponentially and it doesn't travel very far. This is where the force is weak and short-ranged. So this W is very much like a photon. It carries a gauge force, and we know that gauge bosons cannot be massive by gauge invariance. But there is a good example in superconductors where the photon actually receives a mass. This is the Meissner effect. The photon does not penetrate into a superconductor. And its profile is exponentially decaying. So the Cooper pair in a superconductor is condensing. It gets a non-zero expectation value. And this repels the electromagnetic field and essentially gives the photon a mass. So we essentially live in a weak superconductor. This is the vacuum that we live in. And what is this condensate? Condensate has a name. It is the Higgs condensate. This is Peter Higgs. J.D. Jackson was kind enough to give me this photo. He took it himself. So this is the Higgs condensate. The V is simply the strength of this condensate. So we are so the weak force is interacting with this condensate, and other forces are not. And this is why the weak force is short range. So how can we test all of this? So we would like to excite this condensate to rattle it around. So in the standard model, this condensate is simply just one scalar field that receives a non-zero expectation value. We'd like to excite this field, and exciting a field means producing a particle. So here's a potential, and it gets excited, and the curvature of this potential is related to how much energy we have to pump into the vacuum, essentially, to produce this particle. And this is the mass of this Higgs boson. Now, the Higgs boson gives mass to the W, the Z, and all the center model particles, so it couples more to massive, to more massive particles. So we would want to produce it with the aid of more massive particles. So how do we do this at the LHC? I'll briefly go through Higgs production at the LHC, and I'll use this as an example to demonstrate that looking for new physics at the LHC is difficult. Even if you have enough energy to produce the new heavy particles that you're looking for, the discovery actually requires targeted searches and non-trivial analysis. So why is the LHC a difficult environment? So here's one reason. The typical LHC event, except for two protons missing each other, is two protons going to a lot of soft particles. This is a picture of a pileup of several of these events. So this looks like, to zeroth order, like a big mess. Many soft particles. So to zeroth order, to get rid of all of this stuff, what you should do is focus on high energy particles. So here's the same picture, the same event, with only looking at the high energy tracks that leave the interaction point. And that's fortunate. What we're looking for is high mass objects that decay to standard model particles. And due to their high mass, we have a high energy object. So this is the place to look for new physics. At the end of the talk, I'll get to a signal that violates this law. The signal I'll get to at the end also involves many soft particles. But that's at the end. But worse than all of this is the fact that is the issue of backgrounds. QCD produces anything that looks, any signal that you would care to look for, QCD and the standard model can easily, can often fake your signal at very high rates. So producing a Higgs, we need a heavy particle to talk to the Higgs. So in a quantum theory, it's very easy to borrow, with enough energy, you can borrow a heavy particle from the vacuum. So you can borrow the top with two gluons and produce a Higgs through the top. And this will happen many thousands of times at the LHC every year. So we will have produced many Higgses per year. Now let's pick a random mass for the Higgs. 120 GeV is sort of standard. And this, at this mass, the Higgs decays to the heaviest particle that it can kinematically, which is two bottom quarks. So very naively, you would say, OK, let's go look for two bottom quarks that came from a Higgs boson. So they have a certain center of mass energy. And then here's a list of cross-sections at the LHC. And the rate for producing two bottom quarks is way up here on a log scale. And the rate for producing, and this is just bottom quarks that come from standard model. They have nothing to do with the Higgs. And here is Higgs production. So there are, I think, eight orders of magnitude that you would need to overcome to see this. So this is a factor of eight in the needle to a haystack factor. So this is impossible. You can do something more clever, which is wait for the rare Higgs. About 1 in 1,000, the Higgs decays to two photons, again through a heavy top loop. And this can exceed the standard model expectation for two photons. So here's a typical plot in a Monte Carlo analysis. Here's what you would expect from the standard model, the spectrum for two photons in the standard model, and this bump is the Higgs. And you can look for the Higgs in other decay modes and start testing the model, see that it really does decay to, that you found it decaying to the heavy particles, et cetera, perhaps taus. So what did we learn from this? The morale of the story is that looking for new physics can be challenging. What do you need? You need a high event rate because the interesting events are rare. We need well-calibrated data, so excellent detectors are being constructed. You need to decide which events are interesting, because you can't write all of the data coming out of the LHC to tape, so you need very good triggering. You need to understand the background very well. That curve of two photons, for example, needs to be very well understood in order to claim an excess above it. And we should also know what should we expect. We used our knowledge of the Higgs in the standard model to say what it is going to decay to. So we need to construct models going beyond the standard model. We need to construct models based on the clues we have and then produce signals. So what I said so far was that we are in the quest for understanding the laws of physics at very short distances. The standard model takes us to about this distance scale, but it still predicts this interesting particle that we will probe at the LHC, and this is presents its own challenge. We would also like to go beyond the standard model, and now I will go to some examples of beyond the standard model physics and focus on what is called middle model building, which is going from clues about new physics to a model of new physics and then going to signals at colliders. So questions thus far. So what are the clues that we think we have about new physics? So it's the things that appeared next to question marks in the first slide. So dark matter, WIMP dark matter is very important. The fact is, the coincidence is that if you take the early universe and throw into that hot soup a weakly interacting massive particle and let that soup cool, the dark matter candidate will eventually will annihilate, and you'll be left, eventually it will decouple, and you'll be left with a roughly correct relic abundance for dark matter. This is a coincidence. It didn't have to be this way, but this is a particle with roughly the correct mass and cross-section to be discovered at the LHC. We can also learn about unification. Of course, there are restrictions about new physics. Flavor and precision tests at LEP mostly for the electroweak sector. So any model we construct can address some of these issues, but not necessarily all. And we should explore as many reasonable possibilities as we can. And personally, I don't like to commit to any one of them because it has a high likelihood of being wrong. And if you commit, then you can't write your next paper about something else. So we would like to go beyond this 10 to the minus 17 scale, but perhaps there is nothing new at that scale. Maybe it's just the Higgs boson. But at some scale, there should be some new physics. Some new fields will be entering the game. We would like to know what the symmetries are at that scale, what the degrees of freedom are. One thing we know is that if we want a theory of quantum gravity, we should have some new physics at the Planck scale, which is way, way above anything near the LHC. But let's see what happens in the standard model if we assume that there's only new physics at the Planck scale. So what sets the condensate in the standard model, again, is the Higgs boson. So the size of the condensate is related to the mass of the Higgs. And here is a correction to the mass of the Higgs, a radiative correction to the mass of the Higgs due to the fields that it interacts with, in this case, the top. And this is a quadratically divergent contribution, which means that it is dominated by physics at very short scales, very close to the Higgs. In analogy, you can think of the mass of the electron. And well, what is the classical mass of the electron? It's the mass of the electron that we write down, plus it's the energy stored in the Coulomb field that is around it. And if you integrate over a Coulomb field, you will get something that diverges, like 1 over the mass at which you stopped integrating, which would be, say, the radius, the classical radius of the electron. So this is divergent in the same way as in the previous slide. For the electron, this is not a problem in QED, because eventually the positron comes into the game, and when you do the full QED calculation, this is only a log divergence, so this is fine. However, for the Higgs, there is no such resolution. And so the mass of the Higgs comes from some bare term, which is what we wrote down, plus this correction. Or another way to say it, the condensate gets some fundamental contribution and a correction. So we know what this is. This is the 240-something number. So let's write what that is. In order for this to come out correct, we need some number to come up from above. This is the fundamental scale, the fundamental physics that gave us this number, so it came from above. And this is some very large number. And there will be some other number, it came from below. So these are two very independent numbers, they came from very different physics. And so they would be naively random, but they happen to match to 32 digits. And there's some little contribution at the end that doesn't cancel, and it just happens to give us this tiny contribution. So this may seem ugly, and it is. It is so ugly that we decided to call this unnatural, even though it is possible that nature happened to choose this. But it is at least called unnatural. So we would like to resolve this problem. This problem will be resolved by symmetry. But before I go into symmetries, I will introduce a brief anecdote about the hierarchy problem. So this is one of my personal favorites about favorite anecdotes about this problem. Since this is a tangent, this is not LHC related, I'm opening a big set of parentheses, and in a few slides I'll close it. So what would happen if the Higgs bev would not be fine-tuned? So let's spoil the fine-tuning. So we took one of these numbers here and changed it from a 9 to a 3, somewhere at the left of this number. So now the Higgs bev is huge. And what happened? This should be squared, I'm sorry. So to zeroth order, everything would be heavy because this condensate gave a mass to everybody. But we can work around that. We are now in what if land, so let's think what if. We can keep the particles that we are made of, the electron, the up and the down, keep them light. We can do that by hand. And so what do we have now? We have light particles, but we essentially turn the weak interaction off, G Fermi. So what would happen in a universe without a weak force? Do we really need it? And this has come up in the context of anthropic explanations of this problem. Turns out that you don't really need it. We've come up with an imaginary universe as a counterexample. But it turns out the most important aspect where the weak force comes into our lives, and this is very important in Santa Barbara, is the sun. The first thing that happens in the sun is two protons go to a deuterium plus electron and a neutrino. So this is a weak interaction. If you turn the sun off, the sun shuts down. But at least one way to work around this is if you start from a universe that is like ours but with slightly different initial conditions, you can get BBN to produce a reasonable amount of deuterium. And that is very interesting because stars could potentially burn on deuterium plus proton going to helium-3. And in fact, brown dwarfs in our own universe burn in this way, but for a very brief period of time. They're not really stars. They never reach main sequence status. So it seems like stars could burn for many years. We've thought more than we perhaps should have about a universe like this, and our conclusion was maybe it would be fine. But so that that makes the problem even more interesting to me. So let's think about a resolution to the hierarchy problem which involves symmetry. So the bottom line of the, so I'm closing parentheses, unless there are any questions about this anecdote. Yes, it's a much smaller star. It's less massive, about two. So because the brown dwarfs actually burn in our galaxies, and some people simulate that, it was very easy for us to ask somebody who does that for a living to crank up the amount of deuterium. So we got a fairly reliable estimate for how much brown dwarfs live. So it turns out to be 2% of the size of our sun that would give you a long-lived brown dwarf. You'd have to sit nearby. It's cold, probably. But oh, this is excluded experimentally. This is a thought experiment. So the people in that universe would have measured something different, certainly. Symmetry. So we have the hierarchy problem, and we want to solve it in a quote-unquote natural, in the technical sense, way. And symmetry is the way to do that. The way a symmetry works is that you have a field, and it transforms into something. And if that transformation forbids the condensate from occurring, then a small condensate would be expected. So as far as a symmetry and collider physics is concerned, and experiment is concerned, a symmetry is nice because it is predictive. It will tell us what we are about to discover once we postulate it. So in order to demonstrate this, I will invoke this fellow. This is some physicist in a box who will remain unnamed. And he lives in this box. In this box, there are particles. They're all fermions. And they all have, because of some initial condition, let's say, all of their spins are pointing up. So this is a classical sort of system. Now, perhaps this physicist has been blowing soap bubbles and observing that they're very round, and wondering why is that, that they're round? So he's invoking symmetry to explain the tuning involved in the shape of these objects, and he has an idea. It's called rotation symmetry. Very good. So now apply a rotation symmetry on one of the particles that he knows, and he predicts a new particle, which is the spin down. Very good. So so here the symmetry has predicted the existence of a new particle. We have done something that is somewhat similar metaphorically. We discovered symmetry, so supersymmetry is the prime example for this, a symmetry that solves the fine-tuning problem for the Higgs. And the symmetry, the supersymmetry is, you may think it's a funny name, but this week everything is called super. So supersymmetry is just an extension of rotations, translations. It's a space-time symmetry, which is generalized. And it relates fermions to bosons. So for every fermion exists a boson and vice versa. So the top quark, which was part of the hierarchy problem, has a partner, a symmetry partner, which is the stop, the scalar top. Very good. And we are assuming that the Higgs interacts with the top and the stop now in a supersymmetric way. And just like the Higgs got a correction from the top, it gets a correction from the stop. And these two will cancel by symmetry. So this solves the hierarchy problem. Now, supersymmetry is not manifest as in nature. It is therefore broken. So let's go back to this fellow. Let's say somebody turned on a magnetic field in this box. Then that would explain why all the spins were pointing up. So he discovers that in order to produce one of the spin downs, he needs to inject some energy into one of these. So he predicts that the spin down is massive. He will also say, well, because of symmetry, spin up and spin down are related to one another. And so they will interact very, very similarly with other particles with the lab. So here again, symmetry is predictive, even though it's broken. So for supersymmetry, we again assume that supersymmetry is broken, and we have ideas about how that is done. But you can parameterize the breaking in a simple way, which just means that this top is much heavier than the top. So this cancellation is not exact. The cancellation is only occurring up to the difference in the mass between these two particles. Now, if we want to avoid fine-tuning, we don't want two huge numbers to cancel in this relation. That would mean that the stop is not far above the top, and in particular, it is not far above the LHC scale. So we are about to discover this particle at the LHC, which is exciting. We also know that just like the spin-up and the spin-down were very similar, the top and the stop are very similar, and in particular, they differ only by their spin and their mass. So the top is a quark. It interacts through the strong force, and so will the stop. And so the prejudice is that any model that would solve this problem would introduce, through symmetry, some new particles that are related to the old particles. And so we will, and because the top was at the heart of the matter, we will have a new strong a particle that is charged under a new strong force. And this is great news if you're about to collide protons, because any strong force particle is going to be produced at high rates at the LHC. So the prejudice involves naturalness, symmetry, the strong force, and the LHC are all linked, and this is good news. Now, just for supersymmetry, once you produce two of these stops, they will decay. The typical supersymmetric model will give you any super partner will decay to standard model particles plus an invisible particle that will escape our detector. So you can see that if we're not going to see these gray arrows, there will be some energy imbalance in an event that looks like this. And the typical SUSY phenomenology involves hard jets of particles and hard leptons and missing transverse energy. The one nice thing about supersymmetric models is that this same particle is a very good dark matter candidate. So measuring, for example, the mass by doing more precise measurements can tell us something about dark matter. So this is a beautiful connection to cosmology. Here's a picture of a simulated SUSY event in a randomly chosen LHC experiment. So again, you see there is clearly an energy imbalance between these two. The cautionary tale is that the standard model can also produce events with particles and missing energy. The top production, W and Z plus jets, can have similar signals. So claiming discovery will involve comparing the expected distribution, kinematic distributions, of events that have this characteristic between expected and what we see. So this is SUSY. And in general, there are other possibilities for solving the hierarchy problem. In particular, a possible alternative is dubbed Little Higgs. Here, there's some global symmetry, which is not supersymmetry, that is protecting the electroweak scale. But in many of these models, the prejudice persists. The symmetry is relating the top quark to a new colored particle, which can be produced. And this fact is exploited in many LHC searches for new physics like this. In the remaining time, I will tell you about the alternative possibility. Models where there is a symmetry that is solving the hierarchy problem, but the link between the symmetry and the new charged particle is broken, so there will be no new strongly coupled new particle. So there are several of these models. I'll present one of them as an example and go through the very different and distinct phenomenology, distinct once you've discovered it, of course. The ingredients in this sort of model building is discrete symmetries. So in order to evade this link between symmetries and a new strong force, you need a discrete symmetry to be involved in protecting the electroweak scale. And the idea for this particular model is came from string constructions called orbifolds. So again, to explain the idea, I'll come back to this fellow in the box. So he is not, the magnetic field is on, and he has not discovered the spin down quite yet. This is where we are at. And he is still believes in rotation symmetry. So he is postulating that the spin up is related to the spin down by 180 degree rotation. However, what would happen if this red spin up would be related to a different spin down, let's say a blue spin down? The colors here are not chosen for any political, the red and blue, any political reason. It's just random. But it is possible that a red spin up would be related by symmetry to a blue spin down. How would that happen? Well, you would need a slightly bigger symmetry structure, but not by much. For example, you could assume that the world is rotationally invariant. So spin up is related to a red spin up, but there is also a red to blue sort of symmetry that takes you from red arrows to blue arrows. And so you see there's this symmetry link between these two particles. And if the low energy theory happens to not contain these particles, and this is called orbifolding the technical name is orbifolding, then we have this link between these two particles. So if we assume this symmetry structure, we are making a prediction that indeed a new particle exists, but it interacts differently with the world. And in particular, for us, that would mean that it is not strongly coupled. So this is called this was called folded supersymmetry because it uses orbifolding. And in folded supersymmetry, instead of the fermion to boson relation with the same color, you have a fermion that is charged under our QCD, so that's labeled in red, and that is related to a boson that is charged under this new QCD, which is the blue QCD. The cancellation of these two contributions to the Higgs mass is still occurring. The Higgs doesn't care if, at least at this level, at one loop, the Higgs doesn't care if the top is charged under a QCD or maybe its sister QCD. But still, the phenomenology at the LHC would be very different. How would you look for a particle that is not charged under our strong force? It turns out that we will produce this particle because it is charged under the electroweak force. We'll produce it with much lower rates. And how will this go about? So let us compare quark production, normal quark production, to this new QCD particles production at a collider. There is one important practical difference between these two. In our QCD, we have light quarks, the up and the down. In this new QCD, it turns out there cannot be light quarks. That is ruled out by experiment, by LEP, essentially. So in normal QCD, let's start there. The two quarks are produced. Eventually, they are lambda QCD far, lambda QCD inverse apart. And this is the confinement scale. And they develop a strong glue field between them. This is a QCD string or a flux tube. And the energy density is here is high enough so that it pays off energetically to produce two light quarks. And these two systems can fly off separately into jets of strongly interacting particles. This is heuristically what happens in normal QCD. In this new quirky QCD, there are no light quarks, so this string forms, but it cannot be torn. So this just forms one bound state that is very excited because all of the kinetic energy of these guys went into excitation energy. And Marcus Luddy decided to call these particles quarks because they are like quarks but have this weird property. So this strong force is in some heuristic sense even stronger than our strong force. Now, what will happen to a bound state like this that is very excited? Well, it will start oscillating. It will slowly ring down and get down to the ground state. Now, all of that energy goes into some form of radiation. And in this particular model, these guys are charged. They have even different charges. And some of this radiation can be in the form of photons. So this is a little antenna. If you like, that is slowly decaying. Now, eventually, these particles that are sitting in the ground state will annihilate. This, let's assume this is a charged bound state, so it must go back to give us back the standard model charge that it had. So it will decay to a W and a photon, for example, in this particular model. This is an example final state. So what is the signal from all of this? Like any LHC signal, it will involve hard products. You need hard stuff to write things to tape, at least. So these W and photon are hard products that you can trigger on. But in addition to that, there will be a soft haze of radiation from the photons that came from this decaying antenna. So this is an unusual signal. Now, this because there is some inherent direction in this oscillation, there will be some angular distribution, which is non-trivial for these photons. So the question is, can we discover such photons at the LHC? So here are a few possibilities about how that may go. Here is a picture of a simulation of an event like this with many photons in the ATLAS simulation. This was done courtesy of Elliot Chu. And we can see, so what you should look at is these wiggly lines, which is the tracking system of ATLAS. And it seems like there is a lot of tracking activity due to these photons. This is just the photons. There is nothing else in this event. So the photons are converting into E plus E minus in the tracking system and leaving soft tracks. This is, there may be an excess of soft charged particles in an event like this. And this is precisely what people that look at underlying events like to count. So this is a plot of what we expect the underlying event, the number of charged particles per solid angle at a typical LHC event. Well, it's not a typical LHC event. It's a particular LHC event where you produce a lepton pair. And this is as a function of the lepton pair invariant mass. And this roughly plateaus. So one can hope to see a bump above this. This is difficult because several of these events can be piled up. So this may be more feasible at low luminosity stages of the LHC. And of course, your low luminosity means less events. But so this is one way to go. This is very detector dependent. Theorists don't quite have the tools to see if this is doable. Another way to look for this is to look for the energy that these photons deposit in your detector. So theorists can very roughly try to simulate that just by understanding the qualitative features of electromagnetic showers. The question is, how much of this energy actually reaches your calorimeter? So here is here's a simulation of this signal in a theorist's toy detector. And you can see, if you don't pay attention to the squares, that there's a circle here and a circle that starts here and wraps up there. This is the periodic direction. And these two circles come from this antenna-like pattern. Yes? Yes, this is an assumption. So, it is a guess. I'm guessing that some of the energy will go into photons, and for this analysis, we're letting that parameter, the amount of energy in photons versus the amount of energy in glue balls, that is, to be a free parameter. I think a guesstimate would be something like 10%. I can go into that. Later, if you like. And even with 10%, there seems to be some sensitivity. We're still in the process of seeing how this compares with backgrounds. So I'm not assuming that it is going to 100% photons. This picture does, though, so that's a good point. With 10%, I don't have the picture right here, but it is degraded quite a bit. But you will see two big blobs. Now, this angular distribution is very different from what you would expect from the typical underlying event at LHC. So you could imagine trying to recognize this pattern by doing a multiple expansion. So this is a little bit like what they do for the CMB in the sky. You can do that for the energy deposition in your calorimeter. And you see a clear peak for this signal at the L equals 2 multiple, and a smaller peak at L equals 4 because of the dips. So this could be a strategy to find these above backgrounds. The typical underlying event we find has a much flatter distribution in these multiples. So there's a typical correlation between the first, the second, the third multiple in the underlying event at the LHC. It is prompt. I think 10 to the minus 18 seconds was a number that, but it is certainly prompt at LHC. You can start playing with models and get these quirky systems that are much longer, and then it's a different ball game, different signal. Excuse me?
There's never a bound state.
It is a bound state in the sense, like QED. Here I'm assuming that you decay down to some ground state, and then that ground state is rather short-lived because it annihilates. Fortunately, atoms don't do that. So, starting to wrap up, what is the lesson from this particular story about folded SUSY as far as the LHC go? So, most new physics searches are right to focus on the hard signal at the LHC. The lesson from this particular model is that in some cases, some information about new physics can be hiding in the underlying event, the soft part of the event, and it could be useful to look there. So in particular, if you see some resonance, maybe that resonance is a composite that was produced in a very excited state and deposited a lot of soft energy in particular directions of your detector. There may be other models, not particularly this one's. The two ends could be also colored under our color, and that again is a different story. Then you would get a lot of pions, most probably. So in general, it may be interesting to look at, to accompany some of the hard searches with a soft underlying event search. And in general, the philosophy should be that we should cast a wide net when we are looking for something that when we don't know where something is hiding. So concluding, the LHC is about to turn on. It is expected and will make discoveries that are exciting both within and beyond the standard model. Here's a cloud of possibilities of things that we may learn about soon. The path from going to a model to a signal and from experiment to discovery is laden with challenges for both theory and experiment. So one of the challenges on the theory side is what is called model building, going from clues to models to signals, and this can give exciting new signals at the LHC. At some point, the direction of these arrows will change, so information will start going back if we have some signals back to models, and then we'll learn more about the clues. And this is a very exciting prospect, so I'm personally very curious. That's it. That quirks could. So this model of folded supersymmetry is an example of that. It is a full model. This particular model, I didn't show you all the moving parts. Extra dimension and supersymmetry are introduced at 10 TeV. And this folded supersymmetry is sort of the leftover supersymmetry, the leftover from supersymmetry due to some particular Suzy breaking by boundary conditions. So there is a model. The answer is yes. But not at the LHC. It's certainly not minimum. From the folded Suzy story.
Yeah.
Yes, for example, the symmetry structure also should include leptons, partners to the leptons, which are scalar and heavy. With the leptons, there's no distinction because leptons are not charged under the strong force anyway, but there is another copy. These guys are semi-stable, so they may lead to displaced vertices, and even in that case, they could have a particular decay. What they decay to is more model dependent. So there is not a sharp prediction. I have a problem. These leptons are stable. I can solve that in a few different ways by writing down various terms in my Lagrangian, each of which will give me a different signal. I guess typically you'll get some missing energy, and leptons are missing energy plus jets from the lepton sector of this story. But of course you can think of this quirky dynamics as a standalone phenomena. How would you figure it? In the particular model that we wrote down, there is an LSP, which is the Higgsino. There's, for technical reasons, you also needed to add a singlet multiplet, so there's a Singlino. That combination is certainly enough wiggle room to produce a good dark matter candidate. Again, through these slepton production, but this is weak slepton production, it would be difficult. You would have cascades down to the dark matter candidate plus standard model, so you could use the usual Suzy technique.
Good question.
Certainly. Oh, tons of it. Where should I start? I think I said somewhere in the talk that my philosophy is to think of as many reasonable possibilities as possible without committing. Some of my favorites, the Little Higgs is a very interesting model, which is not supersymmetric. It was sort of the first counterexample to solve this problem. Large extra dimensions, where the scale of gravity is actually low, that's a great prospect. Certainly one of my favorites. Anybody else? More favorites? Somebody? Randall Sundrum, of course.